This is the First Time Podcast.
It's us talking writing and publishing.
Welcome to our Masters series,
where we interview Australian and international authors at the top of their games.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Masters series.
Natasha Lester is the international best-selling author of A Kiss from Mr. Fitzgerald, Her Mother's Secret, The Paris Seamstress, The French Photographer, The Paris Secret, and The Riviera House. She's also a former marketing executive for L'Oreal. Her novels have been translated into many different languages and are published all around the world. I have wanted to interview Natasha for a really long time, ever since I was in a long car ride with her, Christian White, and Joanna Nell coming back from Storyfest a couple of years ago. In that car ride, she mentioned her writing process, and that's what we talk a bit about here. We also talk about what role luck has played in her writing career, and in particular, what happens when your book ends up in Costco. To start off with, maybe we can go to the very beginning. Do you remember the first thing that you ever had published?
Yes, the very first thing that I ever had published. So are we going into childhood stuff or are we talking grown up stuff here?
Yeah.
Okay.
We can cast all the way back.
Okay. Well, I'll do two things and I'll do the first childhood thing and I'll do the first grown up thing. So I wrote this poem in year five in primary school, and it was about, we had to write a poem about a season. So I did one about summer, and then my teacher really liked it and said, oh, you should write three more and make it a whole poem about all the seasons. So, you know, I'm such a nerd. So, and I loved writing. So I did do that. And then I must have had this lovely teacher. She said, oh, you should submit it to this poetry competition. And so my grandfather had a typewriter, because of course, when I was in year five, there were no computers. And so he typed it up for me. And then I drew like birds and trees and flowers on the piece of paper, because that's going to make your words look better, of course. And then we sent it off to this competition, and it didn't win, but it got published in this little booklet. And I've still got the poem. Of course, I've still got the poem with all the faded texture drawings all over it and the typewriting and everything. And I loved that. I got to read the poem out loud at assembly in a microphone. And like, that was the crowning glory of my primary school years, because I was there in front of the whole school with a microphone in my hand reading my poem out. It's a really bad poem, but I loved it at the time. In fact, I can still quote lines of it. I won't do that
though. Do, please. No. Just one line. One line.
Okay,
did
so
it rhyme?
It starts, yeah, of course it rhymed. It was year five. So it starts off with, summer is for swimming and playing on the shore. I read my favourite books and it's never been a bore. So I even got the reading in there.
So good.
I know,
I think that'd be
I
a very appealing
remember
poem.
That. But then the first real thing I got published, after I quit marketing and went back to university and did my creative writing degree, again, one of my first uni classes was a poetry class. Here's a poetry theme going on here. And I wrote this poem for an assignment, and my very nice tutor said to me, oh, you should submit this to one of these literary journals. And at the time, I didn't really know too much about the literary journals. So I did a bit of research, and there was one called Overland. And so I sent it off, and that was in the mail again, because it was so long ago that they didn't accept email submissions. I'm really revealing my age here. And so I sent it off, and it was about 3 months later that I got a letter back saying, yes, we're accepting it. Here's a check for $100. And that was literally, and still is, the best money I've ever earned from writing, because it was the first time someone had said to me, your writing is good enough to be published. And that was that validation that you just need when you're starting out, and actually the whole way through your writing career, that made such a huge difference to me. So thank God for literary journals who give writers like us that kickstart that we need.
And thank God for encouraging teachers and tutors as well. Like,
yeah, I know. I know, I've been so lucky like that. I've had really good experiences with teachers and tutors mostly. Yeah.
It's great. Natasha, well, you went on from early days as a poet and in poetry to write fiction books. You wrote two books early in your career that were sort of contemporary fiction and then moved into historical fiction. And now you've written sort of half a dozen of those. I'm interested in that transition. What prompted the move? How come you started out in contemporary? What inspired the shift?
So I guess I really started out writing contemporary because I wrote my first book as my master's thesis. So I was doing a Master of Creative Arts at university. And certainly back then, I think there has been quite a shift now, and there are more commercial writing theses coming out of universities. But back then, it was still very much expected that you would write something quite literary, you know, serious, sad, weighty, all that sort of stuff. So that's what I wrote because that was kind of the expectation of the program. So therefore, it kind of veered off into more contemporary literary sort of fiction. And I loved writing it. Margaret Atwood has always been one of my favourite writers, and she was this huge inspiration for me. And The Blind Assassin was one of the books I analysed for my thesis because, you know, when you can analyse your favourite book for your thesis, it makes the whole thesis writing a whole lot easier. And
what was the thesis on, if I can interrupt?
Sure, no, that's fine. It was on representing maternal loss in fiction. Oh, right. So it's, you know, very, you know, theoretical and, you know, Foucault and all those kind of people who I don't kind of read now. But so I won the TAG Hungerford Award for that manuscript, which is a WA prize for an unpublished manuscript, a bit like the Victorian Premier's Unpublished Manuscript Award. I think, does that still exist? Yeah. So it's that kind of thing. And so that came with a publishing contract with Fremantle Press, which is a great, fantastic independent press here in WA. And so that was published. And then the second book I wrote, I guess just in the same kind of vein, because the first book had been in that vein, so the second book was True, and that got published as well by Fremantle Press. And then I just sat down to write the third book, again in a similar vein, just because that was where I was. And when I got, that was a really hard writing process. I struggled to sit and write, and I hadn't experienced that before. I always loved writing, and I didn't really know why or what was going on, but I'm a real, you know, goal person. So if I've set myself a goal of finishing the book, I just pushed through to literally the bitter end of this book. And then I got to the end and looked at it and thought, oh, actually, I don't really like this book. And I didn't like it enough to want to rewrite it. I didn't have the love to want to spend, you know, months more on making it a better book. And I had a bit of a sulk because I didn't really know what to do. So
that's,
I literally,
sort of crushing, isn't it? Like,
oh, it is. It literally is to go, okay, I've spent, because back then I wasn't writing anywhere near as fast because my kids are really small. Like when my first book was published, I had a 6-month-old, a 1.5-year-old, and a 3.5-year-old.
Oh my God.
So it was much slower. And so I'd spent, you know, 2 years writing this book to then go, actually, I really think the only place for it is the bin. So then I sat, there's a chair over there in the corner of my office, and I sat there for a month, quite literally sulking, but sulking with a pile of my favourite books next to me, because I just felt like I was lost. Like I didn't know what to do. I knew I didn't want to write this book, but then if I didn't rewrite that book, what was I going to write? And I just felt really stuck. So reading is always something that, I don't know, I guess I turn to when I'm stuck. And so I pulled all my favourite books off my shelf, sat in the chair and just reread all my favourites. And it was when I was rereading my favourites, like The Blind Assassin, like A.S. Byatt's Possession and Ian McEwan's Atonement, that I suddenly went, oh my God, all of these are historical novels. I love historical novels. And why have I never realised that before? And just asking myself that question just made me then ask myself another question, which was, okay, well, what if, instead of writing what you think you should write, because I guess that's what I had been doing because I'd started at university and that was what I should have written for that program. So instead of just continuing to do that, what if I wrote what I actually really wanted to write? And that was such a liberating kind of question to ask myself, because it was like, oh my God, I can write anything. I don't have to write for a master's program anymore because I'm not at university anymore. You know, I could go back to writing poetry if I wanted to, bad poetry, but I didn't do that, thank goodness. and I thought, well, I had this little tiny idea, which would be historical in the back of my mind, which I just ignored because I didn't write historical novels. But then suddenly it was like, well, why not? Why don't you write historical novels? So I sat down with this little tiny idea and I just started to write it. And it was literally the best writing experience I had ever had in my whole life. I could not wait to get to my desk every day. Couldn't stop thinking about these characters and these scenarios. I dove literally into the research and didn't want to come out of it. And it was joyful. That's the only word I can use for it. And wow, you know, that's what writing feels like. I remember, you know, back when I first started. So I just kept writing that book in this hugely joyful, happy mode. There was a voice in the back of my head saying to me, though, you are going to need to find a new publisher because your publisher won't publish this kind of novel. You'll need to find a new agent too because your existing agent doesn't represent this kind of work. So this is kind of a bit of a stupid thing to do, but because I was loving it, thankfully I was loving it so much, I just was able to ignore that voice and thought, well, I'll just finish it anyway. And, you know, it's better than the book in the bin. So it's got that going for it. And so then I finished it, and I was lucky enough to find a new agent and find a new publisher, and now here I am writing historical fiction. Yay!
It's been an incredible transition by the sounds of things. You've made that sound very simple to find a new publisher and a new agent. I suspect it was probably a bit more involved. I guess my first question is, when you sent, and this book was A Kiss from Mr. Fitzgerald.
Mr. Fitzgerald, yeah, that's right.
When you sent it to the publisher and the agent that you had at the time, were you right that they didn't?
I didn't even send it to them.
Okay,
right. Yeah, I just knew that there was no point. So I emailed my agent, said, this is what I'm doing. And she said, yep, that's totally fine. Let's part ways. And, you know, I probably hadn't been making her any money, let's face it. So she probably wasn't too unhappy to lose me. So she's probably like, well, thank God. So that was all clean and easy. I was really quite lucky. I literally got an email in my inbox from an agent, and I literally stared at it for about 2 hours thinking, okay, this is a prank. Like, someone has made this email look like it's coming from an agent. And it's not really, because it was basically saying, oh, what are you working on now? I'm really interested in hearing. And, you know, the kind of emails you don't get from agents. And so after I looked at it for 2 hours and had started to believe, oh, it actually looked real, I kind of emailed back and said, well, actually, I'm writing this historical novel. Are you interested? And she was like, yeah, I'd love to see that, you know, when you finish, send it through. So I was like, oh, yay, that's a bit exciting. So I sent it through when it was finished, and it needed more work, and of course, so that was all good. She gave me some good pointers on reworking it. So then I reworked it based on what she said, sent it back to her, went through that whole big long waiting process that you go through with agents, and she took me on, and then she pitched it out, and it was one of those experiences that you think you really want before you have it, where we had 4 offers for the book, and that would had always been my dream to have, you know, different publishers to choose from. But then when it happens, you're like, oh my God, I don't know. How do I know how to choose the right publisher? I don't know. I'd never really thought through the implications of that. But anyway, it was this great experience, and I felt really lucky and really blessed. And in the end, it just came down to the person whose vibe I got best from the email, which happened to be Hachette. And I was, again, so much of writing, okay, there's a lot of hard work, and obviously you need some writing talent, but there's so much luck involved is the thing that I have learned through my whole entire career. And I was very lucky that when my book went out, Rebecca Saunders had just arrived from the UK. She was a publisher for Little Brown in the UK. She just started at Hachette. It was her first week at work. My book was the first manuscript that crossed her desk in her first week at work. And she picked it up and she loved it from the outset. And so I've been with her ever since, because we just have, you know, we were the first together, and it just made the whole relationship really special, and everything's just been amazing since then. So it was, again, huge luck that it all worked out.
Oh, that's fabulous. I'm interested in, so Hachette bought A Kiss from Mr. Fitzgerald.
Yeah.
Was it just that book that they bought at the time? Did they sign you up for more?
It was a 2-book contract. Yeah. Yeah. So, which was a bit scary because I didn't really have a second book in mind. But I came up with something.
So when looking at then second books and subsequent books, this idea of being a book a year author is something that people talk about a lot. Was that a conversation that you had initiated? Did Rebecca initiate it? What did that look like?
To be honest, I never really, you look back on your writing career and think, oh, there were really moments where I should have thought more, but because you don't know, you don't think about it. Do you know what I mean? It's only looking back with the knowledge that you can go, maybe I should have interrogated that a little bit more. But I never really, experience is wonderful. I never really thought about the book year thing. It just, and there was never a conversation. It was just, you know, it was just there. And I, at that time, I felt that I wanted to just get the books out and I wanted to build a name and that was the way to do it. And I never really thought beyond that. There was never a moment where I thought, oh, that's going to be hard or challenging. It was just like, okay, well, this is just what we do. So I did it. And it's really only been the last couple of years. I mean, I was lucky with the Riviera House, which came out last year. I had 18 months actually between the books then, and I really needed that. And after this contract's finished, it won't be a book a year because I can't do that anymore. It's, with all the international stuff, it's just way too much. So it was kind of one of those things that I fell into. And probably, to be honest, if things had just continued along as they were, where the books sold well in Australia, but there was no sort of international markets, then I probably could have sustained that. But once you add all of those things on, the workload just increases so much that for me, it's become impossible to keep going with a book a year. And in fact, for this year, you know, we've had to be so organised with our editorial schedules, like we've had that locked in 6 months in advance, exactly which dates the book's got to be in, how long my publisher's got to turn around the structural edit, then how long I have, then how long she has. And it's all literally mapped out on this massive timeline that we've all signed up to, because I've said I can't do editing in this time period because it's publicity mode. And, you know, so we've now, and that was after having a bit of a meltdown probably last year when I was just like, oh my God, I can't do this anymore. So you do live and learn, but probably if I'd known, I might have, I don't know, would I have done things differently? I don't know. I don't know that I would have. I think, you know, now it's right to make a change. But, you know, I'm glad how things have evolved. Yeah.
I want to get into this, a bit of this juggling act. Because I think there's probably two parts to it in some ways. One is the writing process of a book, and then the other is this juggle of presumably having multiple books happening in various at various points at really at the same time. Maybe if we start with the writing process, how far out from publication would the writing begin?
About, I'm going to say 2 years, is that right? Or is it even longer than that? Sorry, that must be 3 years. Okay, look, I've got to work this out. Sorry, maths. So I normally have the idea for a book and then I won't write anything on that book for about 6 months because I don't plan. I have to let the idea, I'm going to say fester, probably germinate is a nicer word, for a bit before I can know what to do with it. And I still don't really, what I need is I need to have that, what is it that this woman is going to do in this book? Because, you know, my books are about women doing something unusual for their time in history. So what is the unusual thing that this woman is going to do? And that usually comes out of doing the research for a previous book. I'll find something that interests me that I haven't been able to capture in my other books. So that'll be the thing. But I'll need to, that's not a story. That's more like the theme, if you like. I need the story around that theme so that once I have the theme, then I've got to have 6 months of thinking, oh, what could the story be? You know, who is she? What are her problems? How a reader's going to be interested in her? So then after 6 months, I don't really write anything down. It just kind of, you know, as I say, festers away in the back of my mind. And then I will sit down and usually write about what I call a pre-first draft. I write like 20,000 words in November. And there's a reason why I do that. It's all very weird. Which is a really quick rush, 20,000 words, just get it out. Like literally, you've got to write, you know, 2,000 words a day until the end of November when all your three kids are on school holidays and you have 2 months where you can't write anything. So it's like the oh my God, get it all out. So I try to have about 25,000 words done in that month of November. And then I don't write over December, January. The kids are at home. We're holidays. Three kids is too noisy. It's not possible to write. And then I'll come back to it in February and pick it up. And for that whole year, I'll write the book. And when I say write the book, I'll write and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite. I write first drafts really quickly. Like term one is like first draft. And terms two, three, and four are like rewriting, rewriting, rewriting. So maybe I'll do five or six drafts. And then the whole of the following year is the editing, structural editing, copy editing, proofreading, et cetera. So, yeah, so I guess it's about 2.5 years out that I would start writing. Now I've just added all of that up in my head. So
that that first draft at the end of that first year,
yeah,
does that go to an editor or to your publisher at all? Or you would, okay, doesn't.
Never. No, I don't. It's literally only the like draft five or six or whatever it is that I get to by the end of that sort of the second year that goes to my publisher. I don't even read my own first drafts because I write so quickly that there's typos, grammatical mistakes, spelling mistakes. I don't do a spell check or anything. That would take too long. So I just literally, because I'm trying to work out what the story is and it's coming as I'm writing, I have to write fast because I'm always worried I'm going to lose it. It's going to get away from me if I don't get it down fast enough. So I have to catch up to it the whole time. So it's a really fast, like I'll write, some days I'll write like 7,000 words because I'm literally just bashing at the keyboard and it's bashing. Like I said, I'm not stopping to fix any mistakes. So what I have is this messy, grammatically incorrect, bad, poorly spelled, massive words that is missing things, missing a whole lot of research. There's big gaps in it, big holes. I'll have notes like find out more about this in there. And then it's the second draft where I spend more time and slow down and pull in all the research, and it starts to look more like a book at the end of the second draft, I would say, but it still needs a lot more work after that.
So the research, I guess, is the next sort of question on that.
I'm saying all this. I mean, God, people are going to listen to this thing. Oh, my God, what, you're calling her a master? She doesn't even know what she's doing. It's so true.
No, I think it's so interesting because this idea of, well, just that idea of publishing a book a year, I think, is something that people are attracted to. But to actually unpack what that looks like, publishing a book a year doesn't mean writing a book a year, which is sort of how it reads in some ways.
And people think you do that. And then that's why you get all these judgments and comments of, oh, it must be trashy because you only took a year to write it. It's like, well, no, I actually took 2.5 years to write it because I've been planning this, you know, for such a long time. Like this is, it's a career. It's not a book. So you're planning, you know, 5 years worth of work almost every time you're looking at a new contract, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Mm. So when you commence the research, this is sort of in this second stage by the sounds of it.
Yeah.
What do you do? How do you research your books?
So when I'm writing the first draft, I do start doing a little bit of research then. And what that usually is finding a book that provides me with a broad overview of the topic. So, for example, with the Riviera House, part of that was about the art thefts by the Nazis in the Second World War, where they took all of the privately owned art collections that Jewish families owned and they stole them and they took them for themselves. So I needed to read something about how that worked and what happened. So there's an amazing book by Lynn Nicholas called The Wraith of Europa, which covers that broadly. And it covers, so I read that to give me some context. So in that first draft, when I was writing, I had the broad contextual understanding. And I also read one biography of a woman called Rose Valland, who worked to record and to track all of the paintings the Nazis were stealing, which is a character in the book. And I wanted my character to work alongside her. So I needed to know a little bit about her to get that first draft happening. So it's really just two books to give me that broad sense because I don't like researching too early for me. And I never say people should or shouldn't do anything. I think you have to find your own path that works for you. For me, because I am literally making up the story as I go along, I need my imagination to be firing, not my critical thinking to be firing. So if I've done too much research too early, then The danger is I'll write to what the research tells me is possible, and that's not allowing my imagination to run wild, which I needed to do in that first draft. So the first draft is all about having enough to fire my imagination off. And then once I have that first draft, I've got the story, then I can sit down and go, okay, well, what are actually all the nitty-gritty details, and how might that change my plot, and how can I make my plot still work within the confines of what actually happened at the time? So then that research after that first draft will, I now, and also for me, my first draft gives me my research scope. It's like my research blueprint, because now I know what the story is. I can research all the things I need for that story. Whereas if I researched up front without knowing what the story was, I don't think I would ever stop, because I don't know what my scope is. So I need to have that kind of scoping document, if you like, which is all very technical, but that's what my first draft is in essence. So then it's all about always location research. So, for example, for the Riviera House, that's going to Paris and going to the Jeux de Paume Museum where Rose Valland worked, and where the art was all kind of, the stolen art was stored and displayed, and it was acted as like a transit facility, I guess the Nazis used it as that. Going to the archives in Paris to look at all the Rose's actual original notebooks that she wrote to record the details of those art thefts. It's a book called The Riviera House. Obviously, the French Riviera plays a part in that. So it's going down to the French Riviera and, you know, looking around at the beautiful Riviera towns there that might play a part in the book. So a lot of on the ground stuff, and then also taking lots of photos of all the locations so that when I come back to Perth, I can then rewrite those scenes with all of those photographs around me, filling in all the details of place that people love. And the beauty with writing a city like Paris is it looks the same now as it did back in the 1940s. So I can, you know, literally photograph it and then use what's there. So there's all kinds of different research, reading books, sitting in archives, walking the streets, taking photos, all of that kind of stuff.
Mm. My co-host Kate asked me recently, with regard to historic fiction or historical fiction, what did I think made good historical fiction? I'm going to ask that question of you, Natasha. What do you think is good historical fiction?
Oh, I think what makes good historical fiction is where you look at an event that you think you know about and you see it in a totally different way. You realise that there was so many things going on at that time, and that historians have chosen to tell a version of it, but so many other versions exist, and here is another version. And sometimes when I read a book like that, that version will make me want to go and find out more about that version, those people and those places and those things that happened. And I think for me, that's one of the best things about my job, is getting those emails from readers who will say something like, oh, wow, I'd never heard of Catherine Dior until I read The Paris Secret. Now I've gone and read more books about her and tried to find out more about her because I was so fascinated. I didn't know about the Nazi art thefts. And now I've gone and watched this movie about it, and I've read this about it because I was so interested to find out more about that. So, yes, so for me, it's, you know, shedding new light on something that you thought was so familiar that there was nothing new about it. But then you learn that actually the light that's been shone on it is about 1% of what happened, and then there's 99% still to uncover, and you'll never probably uncover it all. So you learn something as well as get swept away in a story that you never want to come out of, I suppose, and you feel like you're there.
I think that's what is exciting about reading your books too, because you do take these women, whether they're real women or you take someone adjacent to a real woman, who are doing such unusual things, you know, things that we haven't really heard of. One thing I'm interested in is often the women that you pick are working in roles or doing things in fairly traditional male spaces. But alongside that, you sort of portray a lot of femininity too. You kind of have fashion or cosmetics, all of, you know, you kind of have these two contrasts in some ways. I wonder, is that something that you think about in your work?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I guess before I was a writer, I did spend a bit of time working in some pretty male-dominated industries, and that was quite challenging for me, coming out of university and not understanding what it was like, I guess. And obviously, you know, for me, you know, that was like the 1990s, early 2000s. It's very different to someone in the 1940s. But then it only compounds how hard it would have been for someone in the 1940s. But I think that I watch things on social media where, like, there was that Nicole Kidman cover shot for Vanity Fair recently, and
yes,
everyone critiqued her. And it's like, you know, I read something which said, you know, if she 20 or like Hailey Bieber had been out in that same outfit, and nobody had critiqued Hailey Bieber, but Nicole Kidman puts the outfit on, and because she's old and shouldn't be wearing young clothes, she suddenly gets critiqued. And okay, there is some issues with photoshopping around that, but a lot of the critique was the clothes she was wearing. So why can't she wear them, you know, for God's sake? And I think that's what I'm getting at. It's like, you know, women can fight for the equality and be brave and strong, but they can still do it wearing nice clothes and makeup if they want to. It doesn't, it's not an either or. You know, we can choose to wear what we want. And, you know, I've got two girls at the moment. I'm really conscious of this too, that I want them to grow up wanting, knowing what they want and trying their hardest to fight for that, but not changing the way they look or who they are for anyone else. Wearing what they want, being what they want, and never feeling guilty or ashamed for that. I think that's really important. And so I guess that's, it is really deliberate. And that's why I try to do all of that. But it's always a choice, you know. It's not saying anyone has to do it wearing lipstick and a nice dress if they don't want to. But if they do want to, they can.
I think that's a really nice message. Natasha, we've heard about the drafting process. Let's talk now about what a year will look like. So we can probably miss January. Sounds like you're on holidays. What does the juggle look like beyond that?
So I'm usually juggling three books at a time. So I'm always writing one. I'm doing the, you know, writing mad first draft, rewriting of a book. And then in between all of that, I'm editing the book for the following year. So the one I'm writing will be for 2 years out. The one I'm editing will be for the following year. And then there's also obviously a book coming out that year at some point that I then have to publicize as well. So often I have to have a quick flick through the book to just make sure, because I cut a lot in the editing to make sure I'm not going to go on to an event and talk about a scene that I actually ended up cutting out of the book. So there's a bit of a refresher before I go and do my publicity. And I try not to be editing or writing heavily around that publicity period, because I find that the publicity mode is very different to the writing mindset, and it's hard to shift in and out of those in the same month. But otherwise, it's just a matter of, you know, I literally plan my life out around school terms, and I try to avoid having big, heavy things on in the school holidays. I'll do anything to avoid a structural edit in the school holidays. Having said that, I'm literally in the middle of a structural edit now, which I had to put away over the school holidays because we went up to the far north of WA with no internet access. So I'm now madly trying to catch up on that. But yeah, so it's all about, you know, with kids and school and juggling around that. It is a juggle. And like I say, you know, I've come to the point where I've realized that actually I can't do the book a year juggle anymore. It's actually too much, and I need a bit of life back too.
Well, it sounds like the publicity for these books is pretty intense. They are published all over the world, or your work has been published all over the world. Do the books come out the same time everywhere? What does all of that look like?
No, and so that's really challenging too. And I guess, you know, that's amazing, I must say, upfront. Like I'm constantly blown away and thrilled and so grateful that the books are published so widely. You know, it is amazing getting messages from readers in, you know, Lithuania and places like that going, oh, I've just read The Paris Secret. And it's like, wow, yay, that's so exciting. But it is, it does add a whole other layer of work on. For example, A Kiss from Mr. Fitzgerald, which is my first historical, is coming out in Sweden later this year. And I've been invited to go to Sweden to speak at a book fair over there. I know. Oh my God. That was what I said when I got the email. So I'm really hugely excited about that. But I'm going to have to go back and look at A Kiss from Mr. Fitzgerald because it came out in 2016. And I'm going to Sweden literally to talk about this book. So I need to know what this, I need to remember, you know, the details of the research, et cetera, that people are going to want to know about, which I have not talked about for years. So there's a lot of that kind of stuff that goes on. And, you know, a lot of event stuff here, which I love. And I'm so, can't wait to do an actual live publicity tour this year because they've been cancelled the last 2 years in a row. And there's nothing better than getting out in front of readers and speaking to them. But then there's also all the virtual events that you do for the US the last couple of years, which is a whole lot of other events on top of that. So there's a lot of talking. But I love the chance to talk about my books. But then I'll be up at midnight doing an event for Europe, or I'll be up at 5 a.m. doing an event for the US. So it's like in publicity time, your day just becomes this unending expanse of time. and you know, publicity then happens all through the year because you've got books coming out in different countries.
Oh my God, that sounds incredible. Do you find it difficult to flick between, because you're really juggling at least three books in your head. Have you had to get better at that?
I think because the books are all in different stages, I don't know why, whether that means my brain is a bit odd that it's able to compartmentalize them like that. But because they are, I don't have trouble. I think if I was writing literally writing two books at a time, I think then I would struggle, or editing two books at a time. I think that would be hard with voice crossover and things like that. But because, you know, one is literally writing, free, fun, imaginative, playing, one's editing, you know, critical eyes, and one's publicity chatting, they're all quite different. So it doesn't ever get confusing for me. Yeah. Mm.
Natasha, I want to talk about writing love stories and writing romance because you do it so well. How do you approach it?
I don't even know. It's interesting because back when I said that I was sitting in that chair sulking and realizing that historical fiction was my favorite, the other thing I realized was that all of my favorite books have these really beautiful love stories in them. And I've never written a love story. My first two contemporary novels didn't really have anything that you could call a love story in them. And that just made me think, wow, I want to do that as well. I want to make sure that's an important part of the book because I think that, you know, people really are at their most vulnerable when they're loving someone in some way, whether it's a child or a partner or a parent. And so it just really went from there. And it's never been, I don't know, it's some parts of your writing process are really subconscious and don't require you to sit and think about them, and that part somehow is, it just kind of happens. Like when I'm doing that 6 months worth of festering in the back of my mind, it'll be like you know, for example, for the Paris Secret, where it starts off with these this boy and this girl who meet when they're like 10 or 11 and then meet again later in life, it was just that was just how it was going to be. It was always going to be like that. It was never going to be any different. And I don't know where that came from or why that came into my head, but it just did. And when it does that, I just go with it. I don't argue and go, oh, no, I don't want to do that. I just go, okay, yeah, great, that's what we're doing in this book. So I don't know. It's hard to answer that question because I don't really know. It's not a deliberate thing. It just happens, and I have so much fun writing those stories, even though I know that there are certain critics and certain newspapers who are going to go, oh, it's a romance and it must be terrible and write it off. But sometimes I have secretly subversive fun, like the book that's coming out in October. Probably shouldn't talk about things like this, but hey, what the hell? I thought, I wonder if I can get these two people to have sex without actually them having sex, but having like this massive big build-up to it. And so I set myself this challenge because it was going to be like, okay, well, you can't write it off because there are people having sex in the book because no one actually has sex, but they kind of, like, there's this whole big build-up. So it was super fun just doing that, you know. I know that sounds really weird.
As in you allude to them having sex, or they never
there's this whole kind of big build-up scene before that, but then I literally slammed the bedroom door shut and it was the most fun thing I've ever written. But I think it's a super sexy scene, but no one has sex. So it was just fun to kind of do that a bit, to play with that idea of, because I do, one of the, again, having daughters, one of the things I get really cross about is the way sex is represented on television and in movies. You know, we have things like Game of Thrones where it's just literally women enjoying rape, and that just, I cannot even breathe when I talk about that. And so for me, it's like, you know, I could stop writing love stories and stop writing characters who have sex, but then all my girls are going to see is things like Game of Thrones. And that is not, I want them to know what female pleasure is and what women's enjoyment is, and to look at it from that perspective rather than this other perspective that we get fed way too often. So I'm never going to stop doing it, because then I'll be letting my daughters down. I don't want to do that.
I think that's great. The it makes me think that we're often told as writers that conflict is the engine of stories, but desire can also, you know, can be the feminine form of that, which is
absolutely
kind of
And that's a big part of my books. You know, it says women desiring these roles that society won't let them have, but also desiring to be able to have a relationship at the same time. And in fact, the book that's coming out in October is really a lot about that whole post-war shift to women being very much pushed into the domestic sphere, and about a woman wanting to have all the things that it was really hard for women to have at that time. So desire is a really big word in that book in all its many facets, because I think it does have lots of facets. And, you know, it gets too often trashed, and I hate the way romance gets trashed as if it's terrible. I mean, look at Bridgerton. You know, it's the biggest thing Netflix has ever had, for God's sake. You know, people love romance. So why wouldn't we, you know? Everyone loves love. We like falling in love. It's beautiful.
That's right. Natasha, you've had a lot of success in your career, but I want to talk about failure. Do you have a favourite failure?
Oh, well, yes. It would literally be that third book that I threw in the bin. But do you know what? Like at the time, I mean, I was actually crying knowing that that book was not a good book, and I'd spent so much time to produce something that wasn't good, and I felt really lost. But then if I had never written that book and I had never failed at that book, then I might never have written historical fiction. So it sounds silly, but it was meant to happen. And I always say the writing life is a roller coaster, and you have these massive downs and then you have these beautiful ups, and it happens the whole way through your career. And in no way do I think that just because one book hits the New York Times bestseller list, the next one will. You know, it's not, you don't get to a point and stay there. You know, there are writers who have a big success and then their next book tanks, and that happens to everybody, you know. So And in some ways, I'm glad it took me several books to build up to, you know, kind of that bestseller list thing, because I know I can get through a bad book that doesn't sell well. I've done it before, and I've come out the other side, so I can do it again. Whereas I think if you have that big success up front, then you've never known failure and disappointment. So it must be much harder to kind of grapple with, I think. So yes, that was probably my biggest failure, I guess, but a failure that turned out to be all for the best in the end. I've got to say too that I guess it's not so much of a failure, but there was this big moment for me in 2018, just before The Paris Seamstress came out, where, you know, that was my third historical novel, and the first two, they'd sold, you know, reasonably well, but they certainly hadn't set the world on fire. They hadn't been, you know, in the bestseller lists or anything like that. And I was sitting at my kitchen bench, and it was school holidays, and so my kids were all there and I wasn't writing, and I was thinking, what am I doing? You know, I could literally go back to marketing that I worked in before and earn, you know, three times more than what I was earning at that, probably more than three times more than what I was earning at that point. And I'd be wearing nice clothes and going out of the house every day rather than sitting at home in my tracksuit, you know, bashing away and, you know, earning okay, you know, a bit of money. But then I thought, no, but I love it. I just want to keep going. And thank God I did, because that book, The Paris Seamstress, was the first one that came out in the US and was literally the one that exploded into the stratosphere. So if I'd stopped, that would never have happened. So again, you know, this moment of feeling like a failure, but you just have, I think with writing, you have to keep going. Yeah, you can't stop, because you never know when that luck is around the corner, and the luck is often there waiting for you if you work hard and do all the right things.
That is great advice, I think, for writers. Natasha, I do want to hear about that moment, or that how you came to know that the Paris seamstress was doing well. How did that unravel?
Oh, it was a bit funny, actually, because, as I say, it was my first book that was coming out in the US, and I really thought that, okay, well, you know, it'll sell 3 copies and then it'll all get returned and my US writing career will be over and done with within a couple of months, because why would anyone buy a book from an author on the other side of the world? And then the book came out and it was selling reasonably well. We had a couple of reprints and, you know, the publisher was, you know, pretty happy, but it wasn't, you know, again, it wasn't the stratosphere or anything like that. And then the luck. So, you know, Costco, the big chain of stores, it's massive in the US and they don't sell a lot of books, but they sell a selection of books. And then the Costco book buy used to be Penny, and Penny would have Penny's pick every month. And so I get this email from a publisher and then literally you can hear them screaming in the email. There's exclamation marks everywhere going, oh my God, the Paris Seamstress is going to be Penny's pick for December. And I almost do my back. Who the fuck is Penny? I didn't even know who Penny was. my email reply must have been so understated because I didn't know. And anyway, so it had already been out for 3 months by this stage. And I don't know why Penny picked it for December. But December's Christmas. Lots of people are in Costco and my book is Penny's pick. And she writes this big piece in the newsletter that goes out to all the millions of Costco subscribers all over America featuring the book. It's front and center in every store. It's displayed prominently. And it literally exploded. Like it sold for my US publisher, it was the biggest selling book she'd ever published. None of us could believe it. Like we're literally all just sitting there going, God, my God, oh my God. Even my publisher was going, oh my God, that's how oh my God it was. And it was because of that, literally. And so then because it did so well in Costco, then Target picked it up. Target hadn't sold it. So like I said, this was a book that had come out in August. In February, 6 months later, Target are stocking it for the first time. That never happens. You know, so it was just this run of amazing luck. Like I don't, and I say I will thank Penny to my dying day for what she did for me, you know, one moment. And I look back at that moment and think of me going, who the fuck is Penny going, oh my God, I should have known who Penny was. Penny's gone.
My God, who would have thought we need to get our book in Costco? Like that's incredible.
I know. It's massive. Yeah.
Natasha, final question. You've been so generous already today. What is your favourite novel, or can you give us a recommendation for a novel, non-fiction, something by a debut author?
Oh my God, that's so hard. I should know that I'm going to get asked this question. I should prepare myself beforehand. I never do. I've always wondered if I had to pick one favourite novel. Because I have so many different ones depending on, I'm looking over there because that's where my bookshelves are and I'm like scanning them and talking so I can come up with something that sounds really good. But no, okay, so can I do a couple?
Yes.
So, okay, so Jane Eyre is probably my sort of heartfelt favourite because it's been my favourite since I was 12 when I first read it. And maybe that's where my love story thing comes from because I literally was blown away by that. And I always joke that the reason my heroes in my books always have dark hair is because it's like my Rochester fantasy. So Jane Eyre, definite like childhood heartfelt favourite. But I've also loved like Erin Morgenstern's The Night Circus is one of my favourite books. Oh. I loved that book. It's like historical fiction, but it's obviously fantasy and it's magical. I think it's got a lot of parallels to historical fiction because you are being drawn into this other world that you can't experience. It's not a contemporary world. So I love that for that kind of sense. And I mentioned The Blind Assassin earlier, and that is my favourite Margaret Atwood book. I loved that book. I loved the whole, you know, dual narrative, unreliable narrator, twist at the end, you know, narrative within a narrative. I have read that a bazillion times and will read it a bazillion more.
You're a rereader.
Oh, yes. Totally, yeah. I don't tweet enough these days because I have to do a lot of reading for endorsement quotes, which I really enjoy, but it takes up a lot of reading time. So it leaves me less time for rereading. I think rereading actually teaches you a lot as a writer because you're not just swept away in the story. You can then look at technique or how does that work and why does that work, and those things feed into your own writing.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.